Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Welcome to The Short Stacks, our shorter conversations with authors about their process and their books. Our guest today is Angie Kim, author of Miracle Creek. Miracle Creek is our July 17th book for the Stacks Book Club, so today is a great opportunity for you to get to know this book a little bit better without any spoilers. Miracle Creek is Kim's debut novel and a literary courtroom drama that has already become a national bestseller. Today in the episode, you'll hear about Angie Kim's own life as an immigrant from Korea, her past as a trial lawyer, and of course, her process as a writer. Before we get to our conversation, here are just a few reminders. Everything we talk about on today's episode can be found in the show notes. The link will take you to all the books, movies, articles that get discussed on the show. Also, the show notes have links to our social media accounts so you can stay connected to the Stacks. Want more of the Stacks? Consider joining the Stacks Pack. That's over on Patreon. Patreon is a website that allows listeners of this show to support the work we're doing. So head over to patreon.com/thestacks to give a little love to the show and to earn special perks for yourself, like our video book club that we do every other week to discuss the Stacks book club picks. It's so awesome. There's a bunch of other perks over there. So head to patreon.com/thestacks to check it all out. Audible is an online database of hundreds of thousands of audiobooks, and they're waiting for you to listen to them. Thanks to the folks over at Audible, you can get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download just for listening to this show. So go to audibletrial.com/thestacks to redeem. If you like what you hear, please take a moment to rate and review this show wherever you get your podcasts, especially through Apple Podcasts. Okay, now let's dive into our conversation with Angie Kim. Okay, you guys, I'm so excited. I'm here today with author Angie Kim, who wrote our July book club pick, Miracle Creek. Angie, welcome to the Stacks.
Thank you so much. And thank you for picking my book for your July pick. That's awesome. I'm so excited.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. So before we even dive in, I already said this to you off air, but I'm going to say it now so everybody hears, we're not going to do any spoilers today. So if you haven't read the book yet, you're okay. The book is full of spoilers, which we will do in July, but today you guys are safe. So in about 30 seconds or so, can you kind of give us a spoiler-free synopsis of your book?
Sure. This is my standard elevator pitch. Miracle Creek is a literary courtroom drama about a Korean immigrant family and a young single mother who's on trial for murdering her 8-year-old son with autism.
That's so good. You're so good. Yeah. I bet you've done that before.
I have. I do it like 4 times a day, I feel like.
You nailed it. So where did you get the idea for this book?
Yeah. So it's a complicated answer because, this is my first novel, and it's not only the first novel I've published, but the first novel I've ever even attempted to write. And people say that you put a lot of yourself into your first book, and that's definitely the case for me. And there are sort of 3 different elements of my life that I wanted to explore and put into books. And I ended up sort of putting all of them into this book instead of just choosing one, which is what I sort of thought that I was going to do. So the 3 elements are, 1 is I'm a Korean immigrant. I came here with my parents when I was 11 as a preteen from Korea. And I moved here in middle school, not speaking any English and sort of, you know, dealing with middle school, not only not speaking English, but, you know, having to deal with the fact that I didn't know the culture at all. I wore weird clothes. I didn't have any friends. I was displaced, all of that sort of stuff. So there was that sort of one element. And the second one, sort of going in chronological order for my life, it was a trial lawyer. And so, I loved the courtroom element of being a trial lawyer. Mm-hmm. Not so much, really hated every other aspect of being a lawyer. And so I actually quit in my 20s, but still that element of being in the courtroom is something that stayed with me and that I love and that I wanted to revisit again, definitely in through writing. And then the third element is being the parent of three kids. I have three boys, and all three have gone through numerous medical issues. They're all resolved, so they're all fine now. But when they were little, for some bizarre reason, all three of them had weird sort of medical mystery things going on. And so we were in hospitals a lot. And one of them actually, who had ulcerative colitis that didn't respond to any standard treatments, we actually did hyperbaric oxygen therapy, HBOT, which is featured heavily in the book. So there was a lot from that element of my life that I wanted to bring in as well. So I sort of like took the three strands of my life and wove them together and hoped that they sort of made a compelling and hopefully original and unique type of premise for a novel, which is that a Korean immigrant family owns this hyperbaric oxygen therapy chamber or HBOT chamber, which one day catches on fire and explodes because there's pure oxygen involved and people are killed. And then most of the novel is exploring how that incident came to be through the lens of a four-day murder trial. So you can sort of see how all of those elements of my life are woven in. Yeah.
You did a good job because I'm like, oh, of course. Now it all makes sense how this came to be.
Yeah.
I love it. So I do have a question. This is kind of personal, so you can be like, leave me alone. But there's a moment in the book where one of the characters, Janine, whose husband was in the chamber when it explodes, she is reflecting on a wedding gift that she got that was, she's Korean, and it was a wok, which is like just so racist and horrible from one of his family members. And I thought to myself, did this happen to Angie in real life?
It did not happen to me in real life, actually. And in fact, I actually have a different association with woks. You're probably too young to remember this, but there was in the 80s a movie called St. Elmo's Fire, with Rob Lowe and like Ally Sheedy and whatever. And, you know, I was a teenager at that point, and I remember thinking it was like the height of chic and sophistication for one of the characters to sort of have a scene where she was in her fabulous Georgetown apartment or condo or whatever with her boyfriend and sort of like cooking up this Chinese stir fry in her wok. And I was just like, that's what I want to be. And woks, they're totally not used in Korea that I'm aware of in Korean cooking. So my husband and I actually got each other like a wok as I think when we first moved in together or something like that, that was one of our purchases or whatever. And we were like, let's do that. And let's have a glass of wine and let's sort of like pretend to be chic and sophisticated, which we were not.
I love that.
So I don't actually have a negative association with woks, but I have definitely since then have heard people, you know, sort of confusing Chinese, Japanese, Korean cultures. Sure. And that's definitely something that I've heard a lot and have heard of my friends who are Korean complain about. Gotcha. And I've also, my husband is white, so we definitely have this sort of like biracial marriage and family, and he's from the South. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff that we definitely encounter, especially early on when I was being introduced to his community and his family. So there is a little bit of that in there for sure.
Okay. I just felt like such a specific story. I was like, I wonder if that happened to her.
No, that's actually made up.
Well, it's good.
Thankfully.
It's a great detail. I was literally like, ooh, this is so good. So back to the book. When you're writing, because your book's kind of thriller-ish, courtroom ish. Drama. Yeah. Like it has that suspense. You don't know where it's going. You're not quite sure. Right. It's a whodunit right. kind of thing. When you go into writing that book, did you, mm-hmm. do you know whodunit when you start? And do you know a lot of the twists and turns, or did they come to you kind of in the writing process where you're like, I need something here. Like I'm missing a twist. Yeah. Can I pin this on someone else in the reader's mind for a couple right. pages?
Right. So yeah. So I did not know who did it.
Okay.
When I first started writing, I probably didn't know for the first year or so of writing. And that was one of my motivations in writing every day, or probably not every day. I'm not very disciplined. I'm very much a procrastinator. But okay. That was one of the things that I was like, okay, I need to write this book because I want to know, as sort of a like putting my reader hat on, I want to know who did it. And I want to know. And even once I found out, like once I decided and discovered sort of who must have done it, I wasn't completely sure exactly how okay. it would have been done and why. And so I actually refer to my book as more of a how done it rather yeah. than a who done it or a why done it, because I think I could probably safely tell you who did it in the very beginning of the book and still have there be this intellectual mystery of sorts where yeah. you're still going through and you're going, okay, I really don't understand how this person or these people that you're saying, you told me in the beginning of the book did it, how that could have happened given everything else that I'm telling you about what all the characters are thinking and doing and all that kind of stuff. But in any case, as far as the writing of it, yeah, it just sort of, all the twists and things like that sort of came to me. And I think I'm such an avid reader of mysteries and, you know, twisty. I love twists when I'm reading. And so it was when I was writing that those would sort of come to me. And I definitely had to do a lot of revision after I was done writing my first draft to sort of go back and just make sure that, you know, the twist came at the right time and right. moving things around so that they made more sense. And then realizing, wait, if this happened, then the earlier thing that I said happened couldn't have happened. So fixing those types of things. So there was a lot of revision and sort of iterative editing and revision going on. But I didn't know. Yeah.
I love that. So I went to lunch with a girlfriend of mine who is also a big reader here in LA. And she mm-hmm. was the one who was like, you should read the book. I think you might want to do it on the show. I think you'd like it. And so we were at lunch and I was like, I don't know, halfway into the book. And I said to her, I was like, Lauren, I think I know who does it. And she's like, you uh-huh. do? And I was like, did you figure it out? And she was like, no, but I didn't really care who did it. I kind of was just like along for the ride. Like,
right,
I just,
right,
and I
right.
was like, and then I was wrong who I thought did it. I was wrong.
Okay.
And so when I figured out I was wrong, I was like, I guess she's right. I actually don't care that I'm wrong. Usually I get mad that I'm wrong. I'm like,
oh, okay.
I didn't get it. I'm so dumb. But I was kind of like, okay, well now I really want to know who does it.
Yeah. So I actually like it when I don't figure out who did it, because it sort of disappoints me a little bit that
sure.
there isn't like a twist that I didn't see coming.
Yeah.
And I'm the kind of person who does like to try to figure it out. And usually the who did it part in books, in most books, there are only so many characters that
right.
it could be, right? Right? Like there aren't that many people. And I also don't like it when authors put in like a really minor character who was like described once or that we don't
that.
Know very well. And then that person like turns out to have done it. Cause you're just like, well, that wasn't really fair. Like there was yeah. no opportunity for me to figure it out. And I like the mysteries where I can figure it out. If I really, really, really pay attention.
If I'm paying attention,
and I really.
If I'm being a good reader, I should be able to get
yeah.
the answer by the end. And yeah, I did get
it.
But like, I definitely was like, oh, it's got to be this person. I'm so smart. Like, look at me.
Right.
I was wrong.
Right.
And I was like, dang.
Right. And that's why I like the ones where even if, you know, because for most novel mysteries that play it fair, like I've just described,
yeah.
you at some point in the book, you're going to have thought that person must have done it, right? Just because
right.
there are, again, like only so many characters that it could have been.
Right.
And usually, and then lately, you know, with the psychological twist thrillers, it's like usually one of the main suspects is the narrator themselves, right? Right. So that's sort of interesting and fun. But the whole point is, to me, is again, like, can you figure out how they must right. have done it? Like, totally. Were you right in that? Yeah.
Right. Because if that isn't part of it, the how and like the why, if those aren't part yeah. of it, then if you figure it out, it's kind of like a waste of your time, right? Like, if yeah. it's not and about the yeah. how and the why, then what am yeah. I even doing here?
Yeah, and not only that, but of course you can figure it out at some point. At some point in the book, you're going to have thought, oh, character X must have done right. it. But like, did you figure out why and how? Like, right. that's the important yeah. part.
That's
yeah,
the fun to me. Stuff. Totally.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So I'm curious, how do you name your characters? Because you have a whole bunch and they kind of all uh-huh. are, most of them have, mm-hmm. they narrate. Most of them are point yeah. of view.
Yes.
Which I'm also interested in kind of how you get yourself to do that with so many characters. But how do you yeah. name your characters?
Okay. So I'm so glad I've never been asked this yes! question before. And I've been dying to talk about it.
Oh my God.
Because
I'm so excited.
I actually changed the names at the end.
Oh, you did?
After I finished writing it. So I sometimes get confused as to like who I'm talking about. So Young, Pak, and Mary, who are the Korean immigrant family, their names I left alone. Okay. But there are a number of mothers of special needs and disabled children in the book. And they all had different names at first. And then once I finished the novel, I worried a little bit because we have such a large cast of characters that people might get confused. Mm. And they all had sort of similar sounding names. So Elizabeth, who's the mother who's on trial for murder, was for 3 years of my writing the novel was Caroline.
Okay.
With a C. And then one of the women who is killed in the novel, which happens very early on, so this is not a spoiler, was named Crystal with a K. And I just thought, Caroline, Crystal, they're sort of similar sounding. They have that K sound and they have, you know, multiple syllables and things like that. I wonder if people are going to get them confused. And their kids sort of had similar sounding names too. It was like Henry and I forget what his name was for the longest time. But anyway, so I decided to change it so that it was Elizabeth and Kit. Which are much more, you know, different from each other and more distinguishable and things like that.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I did was, I can't even remember who, Teresa, I always had as Teresa because she was sort of like the mother Teresa, the saintly mother mm-hmm. that everybody thinks is the saintly mother, which is like a huge myth and stereotype that I really want to use this book to try to dispel and, mm-hmm. you know, destroy that myth of the good mother, capital G, capital M.
Right.
But her daughter was, I forget what her name was now, but it was like a different name that was sort of bland that was another sort of name that sort of blended into the mix. So we changed it to Rosa. And I also wanted there to be more of a, like more ethnicities involved. And so I changed some of the names and some of the details so that it would be a lot more multicultural. In the same way that this area, which is in Northern Virginia, is actually.
Right.
So, you know, so it ended up sort of serving multiple purposes. But I'm so happy that you asked about that. Yeah, okay. It was just like a lot of like, you know, I want some characters to have like four syllable names and some to have one and things like that. Because I did worry a lot that people were going to get these characters mixed up and that was going to be one of the sort of barriers to entry for this novel. That people were going to be like, oh, I can't get into this novel because there's so many characters and I'm getting so confused because I'm horrible with names myself.
Oh, okay.
And I do that with books. I'm like, yeah. I can't figure out who's who. I'm just gonna just give up on this book because I can't do it.
That's so interesting as a reader that's like something that you're so cognizant of. I love that. Were there other titles for the book?
Yes. So, my very first working title, which was abandoned almost immediately, and I knew that it was a working title, but I sort of liked it. It was called Bonbons in a Blue Submarine. So there's a scene where somebody is saying to one of the mothers, hey, your child is not really disabled. And so I don't really know why you're doing all these experimental treatments and therapies and all this stuff. If I were you and I had a son like yours, because that character has a son that's much more disabled than Elizabeth's. She says to Elizabeth, if I had a child like yours, I would just lie around and eat bonbons all day. Mm-hmm. And someone actually did say that to me. That one is really from life. And that really affected me a lot. And it made me feel guilty almost for having a child that was able to talk and walk and run and all those things. It made me so grateful for all of that, but also made me feel guilty that here I was in this chamber doing HBOT therapy with other kids who were much more disabled than my son. And so that really, really, that comment, which was said in sort of jest, and she's a friend and she didn't mean anything bad by it in any way, and I could tell, but still at the same time, it really stayed with me. And so when I started writing the book, it was called Bonbons in the Blue Submarine, because the blue submarine is what we called our submarine, because our HBOT chamber, because the first time we saw it, my son was 4 and he pointed to it and he was like, look, it's a submarine, because we had just watched the Beatles' Yellow Submarine for family movie night. And he thought it looked just like that. And it does. And it did. So except that it was painted blue. So we called it the Blue Submarine. So that was the original working title. And actually, if you go to my computer and like look up all of my, you know, files with the like even marketing materials for the real book itself, it's called Bonbons. Like the master file is Bonbons. So that's that. And then very soon after writing, it became Miracle Submarine.
Okay.
Because that's the name of the HBOT chamber, is the mirror, and the business that the Korean family owns is the Miracle Submarine. And so much of the book takes place in the Miracle Submarine and about the Miracle Submarine. So that was the title for the longest time. And actually, that was the title on the advanced reader copy, the ARC, that my publisher, FSG, sent out to everyone. I think they had like 10,000 copies.
Oh my gosh.
And so that was the printed version. And so it says, you know, those ARCs still say Miracle Submarine on it. And then we got feedback from some of the booksellers that they thought that it was going to confuse the readers and not make it very appealing, just because submarine is such a strange thing and people weren't going to know what it was about. And they might think it was a military thriller, or, you know, because of the submarine, or they might think that it's a children's book because of the whole Beatles Yellow Submarine. And so could we change it? And so we thought about it for a long time and we were really wedded to Miracle Submarine. But we decided, you know what, maybe we should listen to these people who are much closer to readers and, you know, than we are. And so we decided to go with Miracle Creek, which is the name of the town and also name of the creek itself that sort of runs in the property where Miracle Submarine is placed, where some of the more pivotal scenes occur. So Miracle Creek is the final name, but we definitely have the Miracle Submarine all over out there. And if you go to like my website and stuff, it'll say previously Miracle Creek, previously Miracle Submarine.
I saw that and I was like, did I miss something? Like I was like, was this published a while ago? Like, did I miss something? But now it makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
So here's a question kind of about your writing style. Or like about writing this book, I guess. For you as an author, as a writer, what was the hardest part about writing this book? And what of this book came easily for you?
Okay, I'm going to do the easy part first, because it's so easy. The easiest part for me to write, where I just like wrote at a blistering speed, like how fast can my fingers move, were the courtroom scenes.
Okay.
And I think that's because I almost felt like I was back in the courtroom, except that I could control exactly what the witnesses were going to say, which is just like a dream come true. So it was really fun, first of all.
Okay.
And writing the courtroom scenes felt like more like I was writing with my lawyer hat on rather than as my with my writer hat on. And when I have my writer hat on, which is, you know, how I do like 99% of my writing, I'm an extremely slow writer. Like I find writing itself, the first drafting, to be very painful.
Okay.
Dorothy Parker once said, "I hate writing. I love having written." And that's me for sure. And so it's just like pulling teeth to get words out. But when it came to the courtroom scenes, I was just like, oh yeah, I'm not a writer anymore. I'm just a lawyer, just, you know, like drafting what I'm going to ask the witness. And I mean, that's not what I actually said, but that's psychoanalyzing myself. I think that's what was happening because it was so easy. And the hardest part was, I think, writing the scenes from the characters that are closest to me and sort of my sort of personality or whatever. So there are two characters that I think are really the closest to me. One is Mary, who is the teenage daughter of the Korean immigrant family. Okay. And, you know, she is basically a young teenage version of me because she's so like everything from her sensibility and sort of the way that she's such a brat and, you know, all that kind of stuff and her loneliness, everything, and isolation and rebellion and resentment against her parents. That's so me. And then the other one is Elizabeth, the mother who's on trial for murder. I think because she is such a type A personality type of mom who, you know, comes from this atmosphere of she was an accountant. And she, so she was professional and she sort of gave everything up for her child. And she is just trying so desperately hard to just sort of be the perfect mother. And that she sort of loses sight of what it's supposed to be all about and the joys of motherhood. And I was definitely like that for a while when I first had kids and my kids had all these medical issues and there was just so much to figure out. So I sort of went into this mode of like playing medical detective with my kids' doctors and sort of being very type A about it the way that I had been in my professional life. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of that part of me in Elizabeth, the character.
Right.
And so when it came time to sort of write about sort of their deepest, most shameful, guilty feelings, it was really hard to, because those were essentially versions of similar internal dialogue that I'd had with myself.
I was just going to say, did any of your friends or family say to you like, oh, I see you in either of those characters? Like, did anybody ever call you out on that kind of, or is that something that was more just internal for you that you knew they were connected to you?
Yeah, I think maybe not as much Elizabeth.
Okay.
But, you know, because I did change Elizabeth so much so that, you know, she was a very different version of myself. She wasn't really, you know, on the surface, she's not really like me. And also, her child is not really like my kids and things like that. So I think I did a better job of sort of making her into a very different version of myself that's not as recognizable. Whereas Mary, I think pretty much everybody is like, yeah, that's you.
Okay.
including my mom, who, you know, recognized the You family as basically our family. And the first time she read it, she actually called me. It took a really long time to read, first of all, which surprised me because she's a really fast reader. Mm. And it took her like several months and to the point where I was like, I wonder if I should say something. Maybe she doesn't like it. And she finally called me one day and she said, I finished it. And she was sobbing and she apologized for, you know, sort of having for all the things that she, you know, she thinks that she did to, you know, with respect to our family and things like that. Mm. And she sees herself in Young and she sees me certainly in Mary. And I had to sort of say, you know, no, it's not us, it's fictional. It's not right. really us. But of course, there, you know, she could sort of see the emotional core right. of that family as being ours. And so she definitely saw it for sure. And it was really good. It was very cathartic, actually.
That's so powerful.
It was really wonderful, actually. Yeah.
Wow.
I'm really glad to have written the book, if for nothing else, because of that. Because, and also writing the part of Young really made me have to think about what my mom and my parents had to go through from their perspective, and sort of let some of that resentment and rebelliousness that I'd had towards them, mm-hmm. Let that go and realize how unfair I'd been to them, you know? So
yeah, that's really powerful.
Yeah.
This question is not powerful, but it's my favorite.
Okay.
When you're writing, I kind of want you to tell us what your writing setup is. And I read your acknowledgments, so I know that sometimes you eat omelets in the writing room.
Yes.
And one of my favorite questions is, how do you write? But more specifically, like, do you have writing snacks or beverages? Do you light a candle? Do you have a ritual? Do you have a place you have to write? Can you write outside of your home? Do you have to be outside of your home? Kind of set the scene for like your ideal writing situation.
Yes. Okay, sure. It's very specific. And in fact, I would have probably done this podcast recording from my writing nook.
Okay.
Except that there's no Wi-Fi in there.
Got it.
Or very little. Like sometimes it comes and goes. It's that, you know, far away corner of my house. So
perfect.
It's a utility closet off the corner of my bedroom. Okay. So it's not even like the walk-in closet where I keep my clothes. It's like where you're supposed to keep like the brooms and things like that. It's tiny, tiny. You walk in and the ceiling is sloped in.
Okay.
Like sort of like what you imagine Harry Potter's, you know, little broom closet to be, you know, where he sleeps. At the Dursleys. And there's just enough room for a tiny table that's a Korean style table that's low set. So you can't fit a chair in there because you can't really even see. So you have to sit on the floor.
Okay.
So I sit on the floor and there's a laptop and a screen, like a bigger screen. And there's really nothing in that room except the laptop. And then, but it's very messy. It's got like all of the books that I'm using for, as inspiration and things like that. It's got all sort, and it's got, you know, I have a writing group that I give my chapters to, and then it's got all of their handwritten remarks and comments and things like that strewn over in some weird fashion that only I can figure out, like how I can find anything, that type of thing. Yeah, I really need to basically write in that room. And if I'm really into a scene, or if I'm revising or editing, I can definitely take that same laptop and take it with me. And if I'm going to do that, I like to actually write in my car.
Okay.
Because I do so much driving around Northern Virginia and DC for my kids. And so like while I'm waiting for their basketball practice to finish or whatever, then I can, you know, just sit in the car and just, you know, write. So I do that sometimes, but I don't usually, I usually have the hardest time starting a new scene. So for something like that intensive, I need to be in my little writing nook.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's basically, and when I sit down, I can have coffee. I can have wine if it's later in the day. Sometimes I'll like text my husband, hey, will you fix me up a martini and bring it to me? Cause I'm in a really intense part and I really need something, you know, to like sort of take the edge off and, you know, and get going. And I just like sit and I sit cross-legged in sort of yoga pose. And I do a little meditation in the beginning and sort of pray to the like universe or whatever to sort of, you know, help me with my creativity and whatever. And yeah, I go from there.
I love that. So you mentioned, right, books for inspiration. What sort of books were you reading and getting inspired by while you were writing Miracle Creek?
Okay. So I had a couple of books that were in that writing nook that I just refer to constantly. And one is Mystic River by Dennis Lehane. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the reasons why I was actually happy about the title being changed to Miracle Creek, because Mystic River, Miracle Creek. It was Miracle Creek I sort of named as an homage to Mystic River.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, so I love Mystic River. I feel it's a murder mystery. It's, you know, many, many, many different points of view. It's sort of like, and the voices are so raw and so honest. And there's just so many great characters that are all sort of like awful people, but you can sort of sympathize, and they're not really likable, but they're definitely complex. And, you know, so, and they do such stupid things, you just want to kill them. And so, and that's sort of my favorite kind of read. And I hope that that's what I've created with Miracle Creek. So, yeah, so that was one. Another one that I had was Russell Banks' The Sweet Hereafter, which also starts with a tragedy and then sort of like has, you know, four different main perspectives where he sort of explores different things. And the voice of that I just love. So I had that next to me. I also had Jennifer Egan's Visit from the Goon Squad, just because she has so many different voices in there, you know, with the collection of the short stories, that whatever I was working on, I feel like I could just sort of like turn to any particular, any different chapter and sort of find inspiration just from the voice and the rhythm and things like that. So those, and then the fourth is Tim O'Brien's In the Lake of the Woods, which is one of my favorite, favorite, favorite books ever, probably top three ever.
What are the other two?
Probably the Harry Potter series.
Okay.
What are the other two? I don't know. I have to think about it. Maybe probably Jennifer Egan's. Yeah. Okay. Visit from the Goon Squad. Yeah. Yeah, okay.
I kind of put you on the spot there. But no, whenever people say like top five, I'm like, okay, go. I want to hear it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah.
And
no,
then for people who love Miracle Creek, what are some other books that you would say are like a good companion? Not necessarily the same, but like maybe in conversation with, or if you like this, you might also like that. Just recommendations from you.
Yeah, absolutely. So certainly all the books that I just talked about, for sure, especially Mystic River, just because I feel like that's just such an amazing and I really do feel like if you like Miracle Creek, then you'll probably also just completely love Mystic River. I think any of Laura Lippman's novels are very much in that vein of she has a detective series, but then she also has like standalone novels. And I think that all of her standalone novels are very much in that style. Some of the more recent reads books from, and just a quick disclaimer, these are all friends of mine. So
yay, pump your friends up.
So I hope that that's okay to pump my friends up. One is Searching for Sylvie Lee by Jean Kwok, which is, you know, has sort of that mystery element. It starts with a girl who is a sister who goes missing in Amsterdam. And so there's that mystery of trying to figure out what happened to her and things like that. And then as the family members are searching for her, all these secrets come out about the family. And so there's a lot about the family dynamics, immigrant family, racism, all sorts of things in there that are, I think, sort of close in heart to my novel. And then another book that I think is completely different, but also a literary mystery, is Julia Phillips' Disappearing Earth. That's also a recent release. And it's just, it's more of a collection, short story collection, but it starts again, sort of like Jean's, with a pair of girls, a pair of sisters that go missing in the remote peninsula, Russian peninsula of Kamchatka. And so it's a mystery to figure out what happened to these girls. And it's, I think it's 12 chapters, and each chapter is sort of one month after. So, you know, like the girls go missing and making up April, then there's, you know, May, June, like, so each chapter is like another month. And it's all from characters who are all women, whose lives have been either directly or indirectly affected by the girl's disappearance in some way. And so they're definitely short. It's a short story collection that's interlinked stories. And so you get the multiple POVs, you get the different voices, and you also get sort of the mystery, but that runs throughout the novel, and you get to see how all these different people are in some way linked. So that's I think for those reasons, she and I just recently did a conversation together, and we have like four other joint events coming up that we're so excited about.
Oh, awesome. I love that. Okay. I have two more questions for you. One is, because this is your first book and you've been working on it for a long time and it incorporates so much of your life, what was it like for you when you finally saw like your arc or your galley or a finished copy, or like, what was that like for you?
You know, that was just so, I think the arc was the most affecting just because that was the first time that I'd seen it as a book. Mm-hmm. And it was just so beautiful. And I knew what the cover looked like, but the cover that I had seen before didn't have like the gold foil on it that sort of shines. Yeah. And it's just so beautiful and just sparkles. And it was just amazing. And it's just like one of the best moments ever for somebody who creates, because I think one of the wonderful things about doing something where you're creating something is, you know, like if you're an artist, you see your painting, you know, and if you are a musician, then you hear your composition coming to life, you know, as other people play it or whatever. And with my book, even though I had the book, it wasn't a book. You know what I mean? It was just like a collection of words on, you know, some pages that I had typed up and that I had printed out. Mm-hmm. And to actually see it, and it was an actual beautiful book, the kind that you would see in a bookstore. Mm-hmm. It was just, and actually even more wonderful was the first time that I actually like sat down and read it from the book, you know what I mean? Rather than on the computer screen or pages that were printed out or whatever. That was just the most amazing moment. And because it made me feel like, okay, this is real. Like this is actually something that I made and that other people put into this format that hopefully lots of other people are going to read and see. And, you know, so that was just so thrilling. Yeah,
that's
amazing.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And we'll end on this one. If you could have one person read this book, who would it be?
Oh, that's a hard one.
I know it's
hard. That's really, really, really stumping me. I think the person that if there were one person I could have read, I think it might be Dennis Lehane.
Okay.
Just because, or Jennifer Egan, like one of the authors who really, really inspired my writing of it, just because it's the kind of thing that I would hope that they would read and they would say, yes, this is a worthy, I don't want to say like fan fiction or anything like that, but it's something that I can see my book influenced and that I love. And it's just such a thrill for me. Like very recently, Erin Morgenstern, who's the author of The Night Circus, which is one of my favorite books ever, 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 just randomly posted this beautiful picture of my book on Instagram. With this, like, the most amazing, amazing caption. Like, I just finished this book and I've been in the book slump and I loved it so much. It's the kind of book that you just want to, like, just like tell everybody that they have to read or something like that. And I about fell over.
That's so amazing.
Because, to have somebody whose work you admire so much say that about your book is just so thrilling and amazing.
That's so special.
Then, you know what? Yeah. So it was really, really wonderful. And I would love to have that kind of response from someone like that. But then as I was just talking, I just bonked myself over the head because I thought, you know what? No, my answer should be, and I think it probably is. I'm revising my answer.
Okay.
I think it should be Oprah.
Yes.
Right?
Always.
Right. Because that would be amazing. So. Yeah,
those are good answers. I think both answers are good.
Okay, cool.
Angie, thank you so much for being here. All right, we're going to be talking about Angie's book on July 17th. So if you haven't read it yet, you have 17 days from today to read it. And you'll probably do it in like 3 days because it's kind of hard to put down. But Angie, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Tracy. I loved it. And it was so much fun. Thank you.
Yay. And we will see you guys in the stacks. That's going to do it for us today on The Short Stacks. Thank you guys for listening, and thank you to Angie Kim for joining us today. Be sure to read Miracle Creek and then come back and listen on July 17th for the Stacks Book Club conversation. And just a heads up, there will be spoilers on that episode. Everything we talk about on today's show can be found in the show notes. For more on The Stacks, follow us on our social media accounts at The Stacks Pod on Instagram, at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, and check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. To join the Stacks Pack and get inside access to the show, like our virtual book club and more, go to patreon.com/thestacks. Thank you to Audible. Listeners of this podcast get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download. So go to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening to us through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review the show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCright, and our theme music is from Tegeerages. This episode of The Short Stacks was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas, and I will see you in the stacks.